The leaders had agreed with Lee Scoresby that when they reached the next stopping place, they would inflate his balloon and he would spy from the air. Naturally, Lyra was eager to fly with him, and naturally it was forbidden. But she rode with him on the way there and pestered him with questions.
Mr. Scoresby, how would you fly to Svalbard?
You'd need a dirigible with a gas engine, something like a Zeppelin, or else a good south wind, but hell, I wouldn't dare. Have you ever seen it? The bleakest, barest, most inhospitable, godforsaken dead end of nowhere.
I was just wondering, if Yorick Bernison wanted to go back...
He'd be killed. Yorick's in exile. As soon as he set foot there, they'd tear him to pieces.
How do you inflate your balloon, Mr. Scoresby?
Two ways. I can make hydrogen by pouring sulfuric acid onto iron filings. You catch the gas it gives off and gradually fill the balloon like that. The other way is to find a ground gas vent near a fire mine. There's a lot of gas under the ground here, and rock oil besides. I can make gas from rock oil if I need to. And from coal as well. It's not hard to make gas, but the quickest way is to use ground gas. A good vent will fill the balloon in an hour.
How many people can you carry?
Six, if I need to.
Could you carry Yorick Bernison in his armor?
I have done. I rescued him one time from the Tartars when he was cut off and they were starving him out. That was in the Tunguska campaign. I flew in and took him off. Sounds easy, but hell, I had to calculate the weight of that old boy by guesswork. And then I had to bank on finding ground gas under the ice fort he'd made. But I could see what kind of ground it was from the air, and I reckoned we'd be safe in digging. See, to go down, I have to let gas out of the balloon, and I can't get airborne again without more. Anyway, we made it, armor and all.
Mr. Scoresby, you know the Tartars make holes in people's heads.
Oh, sure. They've been doing that for thousands of years. In the Tunguska campaign, we captured five Tartars alive, and three of them had holes in their skulls. One of them had two.
They do it to each other.
That's right. First, they cut partway around a circle of skin on the scalp so they can lift up a flap and expose the bone. Then they cut a little circle of bone out of the skull, very carefully, so they don't penetrate the brain, and then they sew the scalp back over.
I thought they did it to their enemies.
Hell no. It's a great privilege. They do it so the gods can talk to them.
Did you ever hear of an explorer called Stanislaus Grumman?
Grumman? Sure. I met one of his team when I flew over the Yenisei River 2 years back. He was going to live among the Tartar tribes up that way. Matter of fact, I think he had that hole in the skull done. It was part of an initiation ceremony, but the man who told me didn't know much about it.
So, if he was like an honorary Tartar, they wouldn't have killed him.
Killed him? Is he dead, then?
Yeah. I saw his head... My father found it. I saw it when he showed it to the scholars at Jordan College in Oxford. They'd scalped it and all.
Who'd scalped it?
Well, the Tartars. That's what the scholars thought. But maybe it wasn't.
It might not have been Grumman's head. Your father might have been misleading the scholars.
I suppose he might. He was asking them for money.
And when they saw the head, they gave him the money?
Yeah.
Good trick to play. People are shocked when they see a thing like that. They don't like to look too close.
Especially scholars.
Well, you'd know better than I would. But if that was Grumman's head, I'll bet it wasn't the Tartars who scalped him. They scalped their enemies, not their own. And he was a Tartar by adoption.
Lyra turned that over in her mind as they drove on. There were wide currents full of meaning flowing fast around her. The gobblers and their cruelty... Their fear of dust, the city in the Aurora, her father in Svalbard, her mother, and where was she? The alethiometer, the witches flying northward. And poor little Tony Makarios, and the clockwork spyfly, and Yorick Bernison's uncanny fencing. She fell asleep, and every hour they drew closer to Bolvanger. Chapter 14. Bolvanger Lights. The fact that the Egyptians had heard or seen nothing of Mrs. Coulter worried Father Coram and John Farr more than they let Lyra know, but they weren't to know that she was worried too. Lyra feared Mrs. Coulter and thought about her often. And whereas Lord Asriel was now father, Mrs. Coulter was never mother. The reason for that was Mrs. Coulter's demon, the golden monkey, who had filled Pantalaimon with a powerful loathing, and who, Lyra felt, had pried into her secrets, and particularly that of the alethiometer. And they were bound to be chasing her. It was silly to think otherwise. The spyfly proved that, if nothing else. But when an enemy did strike, it wasn't Mrs. Coulter. The Egyptians had planned to stop and rest their dogs, repair a couple of sledges, and get all their weapons into shape for the assault on Bolvanga. John Farr hoped that Lee Scoresby might find some ground gas to fill his smaller balloon, for he had two, apparently, and go up to spy out the land. However, the aeronaut attended to the condition of the weather as closely as a sailor, and he said there was going to be a fog, and sure enough, as soon as they stopped, a thick mist descended. Lee Scoresby knew he'd seen nothing from the sky, so he had to content himself with checking his equipment, though it was all in meticulous order. Then, with no warning at all, a volley of arrows flew out of the dark. Three Egyptian men went down at once and died so silently that no one heard a thing. Only when they slumped clumsily across the dog traces or lay unexpectedly still did the nearest men notice what was happening, and then it was already too late because more arrows were flying at them. Some men looked up, puzzled by the fast, irregular knocking sounds that came from up and down the line as arrows hurtled into wood or frozen canvas. The first to come to his wits was John Farr, who shouted orders from the centre of the line. Cold hands and stiff limbs moved to obey as yet more arrows flew down like rain, straight rods of rain tipped with death. Lyra was in the open, and the arrows were passing over her head. Pantalaimon heard before she did, and became a leopard and knocked her over, making her less of a target. Brushing snow out of her eyes, she rolled over to try and see what was happening, for the semi-darkness seemed to be overflowing with confusion and noise. She heard a mighty roar and the clang and scrape of Yorick Birnison's armour as he leapt fully clad over the sledges and into the fog, and that was followed by screams, snarling, crunching and tearing sounds, great smashing blows, cries of terror and roars of bearish fury as he laid them waste. But who was them? Lyra had seen no enemy figures yet. The Egyptians were swarming to defend the sledges, but that, as even Lyra could see, made them better targets, and their rifles were not easy to fire in gloves and mittens. She'd only heard four or five shots as against the ceaseless, knocking rain of arrows, and more men fell every minute. "Oh, John Farr," she thought in anguish, "you didn't foresee this, and I didn't help you." But she had no more than a second to think that, for there was a mighty snarl from Pantalaimon, and something, another demon, hurtled at him and knocked him down, crushing all the breath out of Lyra herself. And then hands were hauling at her, lifting her, stifling her cry with foul-smelling mittens, tossing her through the air into another's arms, and then pushing her flat down into the snow again, so that she was dizzy and breathless and hurt all at once. Her arms were hauled behind till her shoulders cracked, and someone lashed her wrists together, and then a hood was crammed over her head to muffle her screams, for scream she did, and lustily.
"Yorick! Yorick Birnison! Help me!"
But could he hear? She couldn't tell. She was hurled this way and that, crushed onto a hard surface which then began to lurch and bump like a sledge. The sounds that reached her were wild and confused. She might have heard Yorick Birnison's roar, but it was a long way off, and then she was jolting over rough ground, arms twisted, mouth stifled, sobbing with rage and fear. And strange voices spoke around her.
"Pan?
I'm here.
Shh.
I'll help you breathe. Keep still."
His mouse paws tugged at the hood until her mouth was freer, and she gulped at the frozen air.
"Who are they?"
"They look like Tartars. I think they hit John Farr."
"No.
I saw him fall. But he should have been ready for this sort of attack. We know that."
"But we should have helped him. We should have been watching the alethiometer."
"Shh. Pretend to be unconscious."
There was a whip cracking and the howl of racing dogs. From the way she was being jerked and bounced about, Lyra could tell how fast they were going, and though she strained to hear the sounds of battle, all she made out was a forlorn volley of shots, muffled by the distance, and then the creak and rush and soft paw thuds in the snow were all there was to hear.
"They'll take us to the gobblers."
The word "severed" came to their mind. Horrible fear filled Lyra's body, and Pantalaimon nestled close against her.
"I'll fight."
"So will I. I'll kill them."
"So will Yorick when he finds out. He'll crush them to death."
"How far are we from Bolvanga?"
Pantalaimon didn't know, but he thought it was less than a day's ride. After they'd been driving along for such a time that Lyra's body was in torment from cramp, the pace slackened a little and someone roughly pulled off the hood. She looked up at a broad Asiatic face, under a wolverine hood, lit by flickering lamplight. His black eyes showed a glint of satisfaction, especially when Pantalaimon slid out of Lyra's anorak to bare his white ermine teeth in a hiss. The man's demon, a big heavy wolverine, snarled back, but Pantalaimon didn't flinch. The man hauled Lyra up to a sitting position and propped her against the side of the sledge. She kept falling sideways because her hands were still tied behind her, and so he tied her feet together instead and released her hands. Through the snow that was falling and the thick fog, she saw how powerful this man was, and the sledge driver too, how balanced in the sledge, how much at home in this land in a way the Egyptians weren't. The man spoke, but of course she understood nothing. He tried a different language with the same result. Then he tried English.
Your name?
Pantalaimon bristled warningly, and she knew what he meant at once. So these men didn't know who she was. They hadn't kidnapped her because of her connection with Mrs. Coulter. So perhaps they weren't in the pay of the gobblers after all.
Lizzie Brooks.
Lizzie Brooks. We take you nice place, nice peoples.
Who are you?
Samoyed peoples. Hunters.
Where are you taking me?
Nice place, nice peoples. You have Pansabiona?
For protection.
No good. Bear no good. We got you anyway.
He laughed loudly. Lyra controlled herself and said nothing.
Who those peoples?
The man asked next, pointing back the way they had come.
Traders.
Traders? What do they trade?
Fur, spirits, smoke leaf.
They sell smoke leaf? Buy furs?
Yes.
He said something to his companion, who spoke back briefly. All the time the sledge was speeding onwards, and Lyra pulled herself up more comfortably to try and see where they were heading. But the snow was falling thickly, and the sky was dark, and presently she became too cold to peer out any longer, and lay down. She and Pantalaimon could feel each other's thoughts, and tried to keep calm, but the thought of John Farr dead. And what had happened to Farda Coram? And would Yorick manage to kill the other Samoyeds? And would they ever manage to track her down? For the first time, she began to feel a little sorry for herself. After a long time, the man shook her by the shoulder and handed her a strip of dried reindeer meat to chew. It was rank and tough, but she was hungry, and there was nourishment in it. After chewing it, she felt a little better. She slipped her hand slowly into her furs till she was sure the alethiometer was still there, and then carefully withdrew the spyfly tin and slipped it down into her fur boot. Pantalaimon crept in as a mouse and pushed it as far down as he could, tucking it under the bottom of her reindeer skin legging. When that was done, she closed her eyes. Fear had made her exhausted, and soon she slipped uneasily into sleep. She woke up when the motion of the sledge changed. It was suddenly smoother, and when she opened her eyes, there were passing lights dazzling above her, so bright she had to pull the hood further over her head before peering out again. She was horribly stiff and cold, but she managed to pull herself upright enough to see that the sledge was driving swiftly between a row of high poles, each carrying a glaring ambaric light. As she got her bearings, they passed through an open metal gate at the end of the avenue of lights and into a wide open space like an empty marketplace or an arena for some game or sport. It was perfectly flat and smooth and white, and about 100 yards across. Around the edge ran a high metal fence. At the far end of this arena, the sledge halted. They were outside a low building, or a range of low buildings, over which the snow lay deeply. It was hard to tell, but she had the impression that tunnels connected one part of the buildings with another, tunnels humped under the snow. At one side, a stout metal mast had a familiar look, though she couldn't say what it reminded her of. Before she could take much more in, the man in the sledge cut through the cord around her ankles and hauled her out roughly while the driver shouted at the dogs to make them still. A door opened in the building a few yards away, and an ambaric light came on overhead, swiveling to find them like a searchlight. Lyra's captor thrust her forward like a trophy, without letting go, and said something. The figure in the padded coal-silk anorak answered in the same language, and Lyra saw his features. He was not a Samoyed or a Tartar. He could have been a Jordan scholar. He looked at her, and particularly at Pantalaimon. The Samoyed spoke again, and the man from Bolvanga said to Lyra,
"You speak English?"
"Yes."
"Does your demon always take that form?"
Of all the unexpected questions, Lyra could only gape. But Pantalaimon answered it in his own fashion by becoming a falcon, and launching himself from her shoulder at the man's demon, a large marmot, which struck up at Pantalaimon with a swift movement and spat as he circled past on swift wings.
"I see,"
said the man in a tone of satisfaction, as Pantalaimon returned to Lyra's shoulder. The Samoyed men were looking expectant, and the man from Bolvanger nodded and took off a mitten to reach into a pocket. He took out a drawstring purse and counted out a dozen heavy coins into the hunter's hand. The two men checked the money and then stowed it carefully, each man taking half. Without a backward glance, they got in the sledge, and the driver cracked the whip and shouted to the dogs, and they sped away across the wide white arena and into the avenue of lights, gathering speed until they vanished into the dark beyond. The man was opening the door again.
"Come in quickly. It's warm and comfortable. Don't stand out in the cold. What's your name?"
His voice was an English one, without any accent Lyra could name. He sounded like the sort of people she had met at Mrs. Coulter's, smart and educated and important.
"Lizzie Brooks."
"Come in, Lizzie. We'll look after you here, don't worry."
He was colder than she was, even though she'd been outside for far longer. He was impatient to be in the warm again. She decided to play slow and dim-witted and reluctant, and dragged her feet as she stepped over the high threshold into the building. There were two doors, with a wide space between them so that not too much warm air escaped. Once they were through the inner doorway, Lyra found herself sweltering in what seemed unbearable heat and had to pull open her furs and push back her hood. They were in a space about 8 feet square, with corridors to the right and left, and in front of her the sort of reception desk you might see in a hospital. Everything was brilliantly lit, with a glint of shiny white surfaces and stainless steel. There was the smell of food in the air, familiar food, bacon and coffee, and under it a faint perpetual hospital medical smell. And coming from the walls all around was a slight humming sound, almost too low to hear, the sort of sound you had to get used to or go mad. Pantalaimon at her ear, a goldfinch now, whispered,
"Be stupid and dim. Be really slow and stupid."
Adults were looking down at her. The man who'd brought her in, another man wearing a white coat, a woman in a nurse's uniform.
"English,"
the first man was saying.
"Traders, apparently."
"Usual hunters. Usual story."
"Same tribe, as far as I could tell. Sister Clara, could you take little... and see to her?"
"Certainly, Doctor. Come with me, dear,"
said the nurse, and Lyra obediently followed. They went along a short corridor with doors on the right and a canteen on the left, from which came a clatter of knives and forks and voices and more cooking smells. The nurse was about as old as Mrs. Coulter, Lyra guessed, with a brisk, blank, sensible air. She would be able to stitch a wound or change a bandage, but never to tell a story. Her demon, and Lyra had a moment of strange chill when she noticed, was a little white trotting dog, and after a moment she had no idea why it had chilled her.
"What's your name, dear?"
said the nurse, opening a heavy door.
"Lizzie."
"Just Lizzie?"
"Lizzie Brooks."
"And how old are you?"
11.
Lyra had been told that she was small for her age, whatever that meant. It had never affected her sense of her own importance, but she realized that she could use the fact now to make Lizzie shy and nervous and insignificant, and shrank a little as she went into the room. She was half expecting questions about where she had come from and how she had arrived, and she was preparing answers, but it wasn't only imagination the nurse lacked, it was curiosity as well. Bolvanger might have been on the outskirts of London, and children might have been arriving all the time for all the interest Sister Clara seemed to show. Her pert, neat little demon trotted along at her heels just as brisk and blank as she was. In the room they entered, there was a couch and a table and two chairs and a filing cabinet, and a glass cupboard with medicines and bandages, and a wash basin. As soon as they were inside, the nurse took Lyra's outer coat off and dropped it on the shiny floor.
"Off with the rest, dear. We'll have a quick little look to see you're nice and healthy, no frostbite or sniffles, and then we'll find some nice clean clothes. We'll pop you in the shower too,"
she added, for Lyra had not changed or washed for days, and in the enveloping warmth that was becoming more and more evident. Pantalaimon fluttered in protest, but Lyra quelled him with a scowl. He settled on the couch as one by one all Lyra's clothes came off, to her resentment and shame, but she still had the presence of mind to conceal it and act dull-witted and compliant.
"And the money belt, Lizzie,"
said the nurse, and untidied herself with strong fingers. She went to drop it on the pile with Lyra's other clothes, but stopped, feeling the edge of the alethiometer.
"What's this?"
she said, and unbuttoned the oilcloth.
"Just a sort of toy. It's mine."
Yes, we won't take it away from you, dear,
said Sister Clara, unfolding the black velvet.
That's pretty, isn't it? Like a compass. Into the shower with you,
she went on, putting the alethiometer down and whisking back a cold silk curtain in the corner. Lyra reluctantly slipped under the warm water and soaped herself while Pantalaimon perched on the curtain rail. They were both conscious that he mustn't be too lively, for the demons of dull people were dull themselves. When she was washed and dry, the nurse took her temperature and looked into her eyes and ears and throat, and then measured her height and put her on some scales before writing a note on a clipboard. Then she gave Lyra some pyjamas and a dressing gown. They were clean and of good quality, like Tony Makarios's anorak, but again there was a second-hand air about them. Lyra felt very uneasy.
These ain't mine.
No, dear. Your clothes need a good wash.
Am I going to get my own ones back?
I expect so. Yes, of course.
What is this place?
It's called the Experimental Station.
That wasn't an answer, and whereas Lyra would have pointed that out and asked for more information, she didn't think Lizzie Brooks would. So she assented dumbly in the dressing and said no more.
I want my toy back,
she said stubbornly when she was dressed.
Take it, dear. Wouldn't you rather have a nice woolly bear, though, or a pretty doll?
She opened a drawer where some soft toys lay like dead things. Lyra made herself stand and pretend to consider for several seconds before picking out a rag doll with big vacant eyes. She had never had a doll, but she knew what to do and pressed it absently to her chest.
What about my money belt? I like to keep my toy in there.
Go on then, dear,
said Sister Clara, who was filling in a form on pink paper. Lyra hitched up her unfamiliar skirt and tied the oilskin pouch around her waist.
What about my coat and boots? And my mittens and things?
We'll have them cleaned for you,
said the nurse automatically. Then a telephone buzzed, and while the nurse answered it, Lyra stooped quickly to recover the other tin, the one containing the spy fly, and put it in the pouch with the alethiometer.
Come along, Lizzie,
said the nurse, putting the receiver down.
We'll go and find you something to eat. I expect you're hungry.
Lyra followed Sister Clara to the canteen, where a dozen round white tables were covered in crumbs and the sticky rings where drinks had been carelessly put down. Dirty plates and cutlery were stacked on a steel trolley. There were no windows, so to give an illusion of light and space, one wall was covered in a huge photogram showing a tropical beach, with bright blue sky and white sand and coconut palms. The man who had brought her in was collecting a tray from a serving hatch.
Eat up,
he said. There was no need to starve, so she ate the stew and mashed potatoes with relish. There was a bowl of tinned peaches and ice cream to follow. As she ate, the man and the nurse talked quietly at another table, and when she had finished, the nurse brought her a glass of warm milk and took the tray away. The man came to sit down opposite. His demon, the marmot, was not blank and incurious as the nurse's dog had been, but sat politely on his shoulder, watching and listening.
Now, Lizzie, have you eaten enough?
Yes, thank you.
I'd like you to tell me where you come from. Can you do that?
London.
And what are you doing so far north?
With my father,
she mumbled. She kept her eyes down, avoiding the gaze of the marmot, and trying to look as if she was on the verge of tears.
With your father, I see. And what's he doing in this part of the world?
Trading. We come with a load of new Danish smoke leaf, and we was buying furs.
And was your father by himself?
No. There was my uncles and all, and some other men,
she said vaguely, not knowing what the Samoyed hunter had told him.
Why did he bring you on a journey like this, Lizzie?
'Cause 2 years ago he brung my brother, and he says he'll bring me next, only he never. So I kept asking him, and then he did.
And how old are you?
11.
Good, good. Well, Lizzie, you're a lucky little girl. Those huntsmen who found you brought you to the best place you could be.
They never found me. There was a fight. There was lots of them, and they had arrows.
Oh, I don't think so. I think you must have wandered away from your father's party and got lost. Those huntsmen found you on your own and brought you straight here. That's what happened, Lizzie.
I saw a fight. They were shooting arrows and that. I want my dad,
she said more loudly, and felt herself beginning to cry.
Well, you're quite safe here until he comes,
said the doctor.
But I saw them shooting arrows.
Ah, you thought you did. That often happens in the intense cold, Lizzie. You fall asleep and have bad dreams, and you can't remember what's true and what isn't. That wasn't a fight. Don't worry. Your father is safe and sound, and he'll be looking for you now. And soon he'll come here, because this is the only place for hundreds of miles, you know. And what a surprise he'll have to find you safe and sound. Now, Sister Clara will take you along to the dormitory, where you'll meet some other little girls and boys who got lost in the wilderness just like you. Off you go. We'll have another little talk in the morning.
Lyra stood up, clutching her doll, and Pantalaimon hopped onto her shoulder as the nurse opened the door to lead them out. More corridors, and Lyra was tired by now, so sleepy she kept yawning and could hardly lift her feet in the woolly slippers they'd given her. Pantalaimon was drooping, and he had to change to a mouse and settle inside her dressing gown pocket. Lyra had the impression of a row of beds, children's faces, a pillow, and then she was asleep. Someone was shaking Lyra. The first thing she did was to feel at her waist, and both tins were there, still safe. So she tried to open her eyes, but oh, it was hard. She had never felt so sleepy.
Wake up!
It was a whisper in more than one voice. With a huge effort, as if she were pushing a boulder up a slope, Lyra forced herself to wake up. In the dim light from a very low-powered anbaric bulb over the doorway, she saw three other girls clustered around her. It wasn't easy to see because her eyes were slow to focus, but they seemed about her own age, and they were speaking English.
She's awake. They gave her sleeping pills. Must have.
What's your name?
Lizzie.
Is there a load more new kids coming?
Demanded one of the girls.
Dunno, just me.
Where'd they get you, then?
Lyra struggled to sit up. She didn't remember taking a sleeping pill, but there might well have been something in the drink she'd had. Her head felt full of eiderdown, and there was a faint pain throbbing behind her eyes.
Where is this place?
Middle of nowhere. They don't tell us.
They usually bring more than one kid at a time. Or what do they do?
Lyra managed to ask, gathering her doped wits as Pantalaimon stirred into wakefulness with her.
We don't know,
said the girl who was doing most of the talking. She was a tall, red-haired girl with quick, twitchy movements and a strong London accent.
They sort of measure us and do these tests and that.
They measure dust,
said another girl, friendly and plump and dark-haired.
You don't know,
said the first girl.
They do,
said the third, a subdued-looking child cuddling her rabbit demon.
I heard them talking.
Then they take us away, one by one, and that's all we know. No one comes back.
There's this boy, right? He reckons...
Don't tell her that. Not yet.
Is there boys here as well?
Yeah, there's lots of us. There's about 30, I reckon.
More than that, more like 40.
Except they keep taking us away. They usually start off with bringing a whole bunch here. And then there's a lot of us, and one by one they all disappear.
They're gobblers. You know, gobblers. We was all scared of them till we was caught.
Lyra was gradually coming more and more awake. The other girl's demons, apart from the rabbit, were close by listening at the door, and no one spoke above a whisper. Lyra asked their names. The red-haired girl was Annie, the dark plump one Bella, the thin one Martha. They didn't know the names of the boys because the two sexes were kept apart for most of the time. They weren't treated badly.
It's all right here,
said Bella.
There's not much to do, except they give us tests and make us do exercises, and then they measure us and take our temperature and stuff. It's just boring, really.
Except when Mrs. Coulter comes,
said Annie. Lyra had to stop herself crying out, and Pantalaimon fluttered his wings so sharply that the other girls noticed.
He's nervous,
said Lyra, soothing him.
They must have gave us some sleeping pills, like you said, because we're all dozy. Who's Mrs. Coulter?
She's the one who trapped us. Most of us, anyway,
said Martha.
They all talk about her, the other kids. When she comes, you know there's going to be kids disappearing.
She likes watching the kids. When they take us away, she likes seeing what they do to us. This boy Simon, he reckons they kill us and Mrs. Coulter watches.
They kill us?
Said Lyra, shuddering.
Must do, because no one comes back.
They're always going on about demons too, weighing them and measuring them and all.
They touch your demons?
No, God. They put scales there and your demon has to get on them and change. And they make notes and take pictures. And they put you in this cabinet and measure dust. All the time, they never stop measuring dust.
What dust?
We don't know. Just something from space. Not real dust. If you ain't got any dust, that's good. But everyone gets dust in the end.
You know what I heard Simon say?
What?
He said that the Tartars make holes in their skulls to let the dust in.
Yeah, he'd know.
I think I'll ask Mrs. Coulter when she comes.
You wouldn't dare.
I would.
When's she coming?
The day after tomorrow.
A cold drench of terror went down Lyra's spine, and Pantalaimon crept very close. She had one day in which to find Roger and discover whatever she could about this place, and either escape or be rescued. And if all the Egyptians had been killed, who would help the children stay alive in the icy wilderness? The other girls went on talking, but Lyra and Pantalaimon nestled down deep in the bed and tried to get warm, knowing that for hundreds of miles all around her little bed, there was nothing but fear.